Session number 6042, Reel 6.
Mr. Adams, Reel 6. No, the Japanese army had completely disregarded their own soldiers who had been wounded. The theory being that if a man can't fight, he is useless. The prisoners crowded round these trucks and gave water to these unfortunate wretches. Some of them gave cigarettes. The Japanese soldiers, wounded as they were, severely wounded, because if they were lightly wounded, they wouldn't have been evacuated, they'd have been kept to fight again, were quite mystified at these strange prisoners looking after them. And then the locomotive came and towed them away. And during the time we remained at Conquita, there were regular train loads of Japanese wounded coming down. Of course, by this time, the Allied navies had considerably reduced the ability of Japanese ships to get round through the Singapore area and up the Straits of Malacca to Rangoon. So that is why the Japanese welcomed the completion of the Thailand-Burma Railway. I saw, from when I knew that this official ceremony of the joining of the railway on the 25th of October, 43, was going to take place, I hid myself in the trees and watched it from a distance. And it's rather ironic that the locomotive there featured, C5631, that in 1981 I was to see in Yasukuni, Tokyo, where there is the equivalent, but on a small scale, of the Imperial War Museum, and they have that locomotive enshrined at Yasukuni. And I was permitted to get on it and onto the footplate of it, and I was photographed by it. It's rather ironic that it took so many years to see it. The Japanese railway regiments, who were rather proud of the Thailand-Burma Railway, which can't be said of the British, had raised enough money to bring that locomotive back from Thailand to Japan in 1979, along with another one, another locomotive, which is now in service in Japan. So our time came to an end at Conquita, and it was a mercy that instead of having to walk back to the base, we got onto trucks. The trucks, having got onto the trucks, which were flat cars, not covered ones, and we discovered we weren't going very far. Of course, having got onto them and been counted umpteen times by our guards, they didn't move for 4 hours. And during this period, people got on and off the trucks for the call of nature, and some Australians in my truck went off and raided a little bit of a Japanese camp and stole all the chickens and wrung their neck. Fortunately, the loss wasn't discovered till after the train was moving. And we went down the line a while to a camp called Hindato, which is the largest single camp I was in. There were 7,000 prisoners in it, mostly British and Australian, but some Dutch. It was, in fact, a collection camp for railway gangs till they were moved farther down the line. But the Japanese were never people, and never are now for that matter, people to have idle hands. So the prisoners went out to work every day, ballasting the railway, cutting wood for the railway, building water towers for the locomotives, and also building a road alongside the railway. So by the time we left the Hindato area, there was not only a serviceable railway line, but there was also a decent road, not metalled, but a fairly good graded road. And I'm told that it held up right to the end of the war, and certainly the road at Hindato, I saw traces of it in 1981 when I was visiting Thailand. So it was a well-constructed road by prisoners under the control of Japanese engineers. Rather the reverse of Alec Guinness as the colonel in the film, where he was the controller and the designer. Rather different. At Hindato, we had an easy life. Normal sort of British factory working hours. Not very good food. The Japanese allowed us to put on such shows as one can put on. I helped stage one or two of them. They were, of course, pure corny. We always got a standing ovation, possibly because there were no seats. But our time at Hindata wasn't bad, and it was enlivened by the fact that a big distribution of mail took place there. We hadn't had any mail. We'd only had one previous issue of mail in our entire captivity, and a lot of mail came. I was a very lucky chap. I got four letters, all of which had been written 18 months before, but they, in fact, were contact with home. And, of course, those who did not get letters, they were not forgotten, because those who did get letters let the others read their letters, so you felt as if you were... going. There was the son of a very famous Englishman in that camp, or rather, I should say, a very famous Scotsman in that camp, and he got a letter from his mother. And it was very stiff British upper lip. It said, I won't say his name, Dear X, hope you are well. The grouse are rising well, the salmon are biting well. Love, Mother. I'm certain if he heard this, he would know who it was about, but I'm not going to identify him. Perhaps I'll tell you when you're not recording, Conrad. So we're at Hindato. First, our first sign of the Allies came there, because on several successive nights and several successive days, the Japanese became very het up because some very high-flying British aircraft, reconnaissance aircraft, it turned out, flew over Hindato. After the war, I was to find the aerial photographs that these planes had taken. They were surveying the railway prior to bombing it. But at this stage, there had been no bombing of the railway. Came the day when we had to move down to the base. But before that, some friends of mine in the artillery, a party of 20 with one officer, Lieutenant Wilkinson, went off to a working party one day. And when they came back in the afternoon, they said what a wonderful time they'd had in the working party, and they were going to have the same job every day from then onwards. It turned out that the Japanese had set up an army field brothel at some nearby hot springs, which are still there to this day, by the way. Hindato Hot Springs. It's a sort of tourist attraction now. They set up a brothel there, and this party of artillerymen, prisoners, were there to do the gardening and the general dusting and cleaning of the place. And Wilkie said that the whores looked after them very well while we were there, in the form of giving them food, cigarettes, and as much water to drink as they wanted, and occasionally a drink of beer. And until the time we left Hindato, Wilkie and his 20 always went to work at the brothel. An unusual occupation for a prisoner of war, or for an artillery officer, for that matter.
Did they get any other favours from the whores?
No, they'd never said they did, but I don't think they would either, because they were army whores, so they were under Japanese military discipline. It was interesting that they had an officer's wing and another rank's wing. And it appeared that this brothel was for the use of Japanese working on the railway, prison camp guards, and there was a transit camp there, which I've described quite a while ago, for Japanese troops on the way to Burma. So possibly it's the last visit to a brothel that some of the Japanese had before they were killed by General Slim's army. But the Japanese did have army brothels scattered over various places. As later, I was to see Russian army brothels, mobile brothels, where the whole back of a truck was converted into a gigantic bed. So we're back to the base. We moved back, in fact, to within 3 kilometres of where we had first landed in Thailand. A village or a POW camp called Nampadok, just 3 kilometres from Ban Pong. There had been a POW camp at Nam Pradok since June 1942. That was called Nam Pradok 1. we went into this massive camp, Nampaduk 2, where all the inhabitants of Hindato travelled 200 kilometres and set themselves up at Nampaduk 2. Well, really, they got very little work for us to do, and the work was rationed out because it became interesting to go out of camp rather than stop in camp. The work there was not onerous, carrying wood, carrying stores, loading ballast onto trains for the railway, and things of that nature. For me, it became a great pleasure going out of the camp, because it became very boring inside the camp after the time we'd had of not being fenced in. We were there fenced in, although you could have walked out after dark if you wished to. Not by walking through the main gate, of course, but just climbing over the simple bamboo fence. But on the way to the town where you used to go to collect wood for the railway or for the camp, you passed the local slaughterhouse, abattoir, and they had a very simple method of disposing of the uneatable part of the animal, rather like you saw the seagulls after lunch today, Conrad. They chucked it all out of the slaughterhouse door, and when they'd finished slaughtering for the day, which they did by about noon, and all the slaughtermen went away and the meat had been disposed of to butchers' shops, the vultures then descended and ate all the part that human beings didn't want. And we would pass this slaughterhouse quite early in the morning, and the vultures would be sitting in one big tree that was by the side of the abattoir. And the vulture is a very big bird, and when the prisoners went under the tree, we'd all shout and it would make the vultures rise, and their weight on the branches, as all the vultures took off to circle round before they alighted again, the branches would go up at least 6 to 8 feet until the vultures resettled onto the branch. So we bedded in at Nampaduk, and the food wasn't good, but the conditions were not bad. And don't forget, we'd had 2 years of getting accustomed to making do with what there was. Football matches were started up again. Apart from a few very privileged or lucky people, there weren't many boots around by this time. The monsoon mud of the railway had sucked those off your feet. The Japanese had not issued any. Clothing was scarce. There were some people who'd been in the base all the time that were not badly dressed. But we organised shows. I was one of the three officers who helped organise a great show on St. George's Day, 1944, and another gigantic one on Empire Day, 1944. Of course, we're not allowed to mention the word empire anymore. But during it, I took part in a skit involving a German aeroplane. And because we knew that the Japanese were touchy about the Germans, their allies, they intervened during the show to stop this particular little skit. And they were mollified, and they threatened to take away all the lights which they loaned us for the show. They were mollified by the fact that we told them that the skit was not based on World War II, but was based on the Germans in World War I when the Japanese also fought against the Germans. And the show went on. But shortly after this Empire Day show, the Japanese started sending prisoners of war away from Thailand to Japan. And it became very quickly apparent that the Japanese were not taking the very sick to Japan. They gave their usual spiel that conditions in Japan would be great, that the barracks were good, the food was good, Japan was winning the war, and one day Japan would win the war and we'd all go home, and that the British would like the climate in Japan better than Thailand because Japan, like England, was a temperate climate. Also, it became quite apparent that the parties were of a standard format. 150 other ranks, one officer, one medical orderly or one doctor. At first, they were all volunteers. In other words, the Japanese would say to the British command, or the Dutch command, or the Australian command, we want 150 men or 450 men. And they were generally moved in batches of 450. Well, in fact, 456. And then the prisoners' command would say, well, who'd like to volunteer to go to Japan? But after the first two or three of this volunteering game, there were no more volunteers because the bulk of people thought, well, here the Allies are only 2,000 miles away. When we're in Japan, the Allies will be many, many thousands of miles away, and Japan will be the last place to collapse at the end of the war. I'll stick it out here. At least we are warm here. And by mid-June, they had taken quite a few groups of prisoners away, of all nationalities. At one time, until quite late in June, they wouldn't take any coloured Dutchmen. Much of the Dutch East Indies Army was consisted of half-castes, partly Dutch, partly Javanese. And at first they only took white Dutchmen, Dutchmen from Holland. But as the source of those dried up, they then got to taking half-caste Dutchmen, half-caste Dutch Javanese, half-caste Dutch Sumatran, half-caste Dutch Salabian. Because, you know, the Dutch, as part of their colonial policy, anyone who had more than a certain amount of Dutch blood counted as a Dutchman. And came the time when the Japanese gave an order for another 450 British. And by this time, word had come back, incredibly how word comes back when you lack communication, that one or two of the ships carrying prisoners to Japan had been sunk. I think I know how it came back is because the guards used to go with them and sometimes write to Japan, and then the guards would come back to Thailand and they would hear of these sinkings. So the source of volunteers dried up completely. And then a party was being organised, basically of people who I'd been with a long time. By, I don't mean necessarily close friends, but people I'd been associated with. A party of Northumberland Fusiliers, which was to consist of Northumberland Fusiliers, Royal Court of Signals, another party of Australians mixed with Dutchmen, and a party of Royal Engineers, Royal Army Ordnance Corps, Royal Army Service Corps. And I was asked, as there weren't many RASC officers in the camp, I was asked if I would be the officer with the RASC, RE, RAOC lot. And having checked with the two friends of mine, Captain Janice, Morris Janice, who went to Japan with me in 1981, by the way, if he would also go, and with Dr. Christensen, Captain Christensen, if he would also go, we three agreed. We thought we'd like to stop together. And with the addition of John Bowen of the Northumberland Fusiliers, who came from Warwickshire, he came from Warwickshire, the Northumberland Fusiliers didn't. We thought we'd make a nice little team of 456. And of course we all knew many of the men under us. So the day came when we were lined up in the camp, having been selected and checked, and we'd all got four limbs. We were complete people, all got marks of ulcers on our legs, but complete people. There were many amputees in Thailand from tropical ulcers, of course. And we were inspected. And we knew that having been inspected, we'd be allowed back into our huts. So anything that was contraband, we'd left in the huts. So we were inspected and they found nothing. So we then went back into the huts, had our last meal in Nam Phuoc camp, and then marched out of the camp. But the Japanese were one ahead of us on this occasion. We got just out of the camp and we were halted, and there we were searched. And of course, it was Pandora's box. There was nothing they didn't find there, but it was confiscated. My diary was confiscated at that point. I had a diary in minute handwriting, and because I was very proficient in shorthand, all my diary notes were in shorthand backwards. So literally I was the only one that could transcribe them. I often wondered what the Japanese, when they got round to looking at this diary, would have made of it. Perhaps they'd have shot me as a spy or something. And I kept it in an old diary that I had in my pocket when I was captured, issued by the British magazine, the Meat Trade Journal. Someone had sent it to me as a present in my last Christmas in England, the Meat Trade Journal diary. Anyway, that was confiscated, along with a very nice knife that my Japanese blacksmith had made when I was his striker, a little sort of dagger-type knife. That was confiscated, along with lots of other things that were confiscated. Fortunately, my nail scissors I placed with Dr. Christensen in his medical bag, and that wasn't touched. And we marched down the road, past the slaughterhouse, to Banpong Station, got on the train, the same sort of train on which we'd come up, but we weren't quite as crowded because they'd still given 30 steel cars, but for only 450. And then we started our 4-night and 5-day journey back to Singapore, where we were, again, marched through the streets, obviously exhibited as prisoners and the hated British, showing how low the British have come. And we finished up at a deserted old POW camp in Singapore by Havelock Road and River Valley Road. The camp was quite overrun with rats, and the first night we had a competition, a sweep, to see who could catch the most rats. And the Northumberland Fusiliers Company caught the most. They caught 400 rats, and the rats were as big as cats. Again, rather reminiscent of the descriptions one can read of the trenches in World War I in Flanders and northern France. There were rats as big as bloody cats, and they were running on the rafters. And these particular huts consisted of a roof and 3 platforms for you to sleep on. And the rats would run over the rafters, and if you shook the thing would fall off and drop on someone underneath. But it gave the rats a fair belting when you think that one company killed, basically barehanded or with sticks, 400 rats, and the others had caught them as well. We stewed there on atrocious food. The most atrocious thing about it was a crate, a wicker basket of stinking fish heads that they brought in to provide us with protein. But they went into the cookhouse and they were boiled and boiled and boiled. They were all our own cooks, of course. They were boiled and boiled and boiled till these stinking fish heads had worked into a mush. And perhaps the fact they were stinking so much gave them a bit of flavour. And it just made a fish soup over rice. After a week of that, we marched down to the docks. Some motorised lighters came alongside. Don't forget, we got every possession that we owned on our backs. It was dry, it was sunny, and compared with our previous leaving of Singapore 2 years ago, when we'd seen the Japanese flags out and people rather friendly to the Japanese, this time there were surreptitious waves to us and thumbs up and goodness knows what. And when we stopped, a lot of the local Chinese and Malays brought us out water to drink. But we got onto the lighters, and I suppose we went out about a mile into the Singapore roads, that's the water roads, and then we had a hazardous time timing jumping from the lighter onto the deck of the Hiroki Maru. The Hiroki Maru, a 4,000-ton cargo ship, fully loaded, way below the Plimsoll line. It was in fact loaded with scrap iron being taken to Japan. A scrap iron and other thing, and rubber. And it was quite hazardous timing the top of a wave to jump from the deck of the lighter onto the deck of the Hiroki Maru. And I think at this point, when we are all fortunately safely on the Hiroki Maru, preparing to wait out our departure for what it turned out to be Japan, I think I should close at this stage. So here we were on the Japanese merchant ship Hiyoki Maru. The Hiyoki Maru, we discovered, was a 4,000-ton merchant ship, wartime built, rather like the American Liberty Ship program, and she was heavily loaded, far below the Plimsoll line, with, I believe, scrap metal and rubber, bound for the islands of Japan. As we boarded, we were hustled in to a very confined space on some shelves, that's the only way they can be described, rigged above a hold and part of the coal bunkers. And it became very apparent that there was not room for 455 men in this rabbit hutch. However, we were pushed in by the guards and the watertight door was shut. It quickly became very unbearable in the tremendous heat of Singapore, and we started hammering on the door, at which they opened the door, and after our complaints they allowed the door to remain open and guards stood across the front so that we could not see out of the door. The only ventilation was from two of these watertight doors, and the lighting was from blue lights irregularly scattered round the ceiling. From various notices on the wall, it also became obvious that the ship had carried Japanese troops in similar conditions, and presumably they did not complain. We stayed there for about an hour, during which time some people passed out through lack of air, and a great hubbub was set up, and the Japanese officer in charge of us, Lieutenant Kawai, who had been on the railway in Thailand with us, he came to see what was the matter. Captain Janis, who was quite proficient in Japanese, led a little delegation of the two officers, Bowen and myself, and the doctor, David Christensen, heard what we had to say and said he would see what could be done once we had left Singapore and had gone through the minefields. But he could not possibly let us out on deck because he didn't want us to see the minefields. A fat lot it would have done us if we could have seen them. However, the hours went by and the anchor chain rattled and the engine started and we moved off through the so-called minefields, but did not see them. Once we were clear of Singapore, we set an easterly course and then we again made our complaints about the accommodation and the lack of air. And Kawai, who was not a very unreasonable man, came down with the ship's captain. This was a merchant ship. The ship's captain and the ship's officers and crew were a fairly nice set of chaps. Most of them were elderly, and they, of course, had been all over the world, and they'd seen parts of the world other than Japan. A compromise was reached that at any time there would be one-third of us, 150, in this confinement quarter, and two-thirds on deck, on the open deck. And that is how the rest of the voyage occurred. The ship had very primitive cooking arrangements for us, a great shortage of fresh water, which would be common to most small cargo ships anywhere, and had no means of making fresh water. And they had not great storage capacity, so water was restricted to 1 pint per man per day, plus some water for cooking rice. I took on the job of organising the cooking, and sometimes we had one meal a day, and sometimes we managed two.